ICE raid on a battery factory in Georgia, and Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh. Shaken Baby Syndrome, and Taylor Swift's new album. Welcome to Downsampled News. Hello and welcome to Downsampled News. My name is Bilak and I am here virtually with my father,
Richie B.
We are on location today because, Dad, you might be familiar with the place I am. I'm at my brother's house, your son's house, watching his dogs. So that is why we're on location today. So if there is dog barking in the background, don't blame me, blame Chris.
And I am an undisclosed location in our basement. So.
Yes, absolutely. So let's get started today. I did want to preface in this past month, there was like one particularly really big news story. We are not talking about assassinations today. Not that it's not an important news story, but it has been covered very, very thoroughly. And you do not need another hot take. We're focusing on some other things.
Brush on it briefly. But anyway, okay. So what I want to talk about, which was an unusual kind of a thing, there was an ICE raid at the construction site in Georgia where Hyundai, which is a South Korean company, and LG, which is another South Korean company, have been contracted by Georgia and United States to build a factory to produce batteries for cars. Mm-hmm. So ICE invaded the thing and they arrested, they basically put like 400 people in shackles and took them away to detention centers, right? And allegedly they were illegal immigrants. Over 300 of them, of those people were South Koreans. Many engineers who were in the United States helping build this factory. So South Korea got really, really pissed off.
Yep.
Because even if there were some issues with visas, and I'll talk a little bit about that, they probably could have been handled a little bit better than putting people in shackles and dragging them off to detention centers and keeping them there. Eventually, all those people were, you know, sent back to South Korea. But I was reading a bunch of articles about it. Like one of them, this was even New York Times, one of the lawyers for the detained South Koreans said the following. Two of his clients were in this country on the visa waiver, which is basically there's a waiver that you can come to the country for like 3 months for business meetings or whatever, or vacation. And there were some people who arrived like that week.
Oh. That's awful to like just popping up in the United States and like a week later, ICE is putting you in shackles illegally.
Right,
And so gosh.
The thing about this factory, it's really being built to employ Americans to build batteries and for cars. And it's a big investment that South Korea is making in the United States. So this factory was like $250 million that's been invested into it. And let's see. As a result of this, well, South Koreans are very upset, so they're reconsidering their investments in America. Now, South Korea and Georgia have been doing this kind of stuff for a while. Like South Korea invested in some factories, car factories, back in starting 2005. You know, so it's not anything new. So the problem was with the visas, right? So there's some weird regulations about these visa waivers, what kind of stuff you can do or not. And for example, you're not supposed to do any manual labor, whatever that is. So technically, maybe some of those people were not legally doing what they were supposed to do, but this is not sort of the kind of approach you want to take.
It's not the kind of thing you go to jail for.
it's not even to jail. It's just like thrown into without any kind of due process or anything, just grabbed, shackled in chains. I mean, this is engineers, right, working at the factory site. And so these were engineers who were, you know, working, helping, teaching Americans how to build factories and maybe training them on machinery and whatnot. And they were just grabbed and dragged away in vans. There was like, if you saw a clip of the raid, it was like a whole bunch of military vehicles with men with guns. Mm-hmm. It's a big, big show.
Yeah. And those people are all out now?
Yes. So the people who were detained were mostly sent to South Korea. They went back and, you know, they don't want to come back.
Yep. Now who's going to build the factory?
So one of the things that was said by the South Korean president in a press conference, he said this could significantly impact future direction of investments in the U.S., mm-hmm. adding that the raid would make South Korean companies very hesitant about investing in the U.S. He also called the raid and the images coming out of bewildering. Again, mm-hmm. if there was legal problems with the visas, you know, there are other ways to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, when I said like you don't go to jail for it, what I mean is that this is not the kind of infraction that like you lose your liberty for. You know, it's like this is like there are things people do that like you end up losing your liberty for, like, you know, serious crimes. But this is not one of those.
Right. So I looked up something that was written in the conservative population, conservative publication, and. Mm-hmm. It says the following. The majority of the workers arrested were working in the United States on ESTA visas. ESTA allows foreign workers who are performing instructions or teaching workshops to work in the United States. Under the terms of ESTA, foreign workers are not allowed to perform manual labor. However, most of the 300 Korean workers arrested in the plant were performing dangerous, hard manual labor. So they were claiming this was a like trafficking of humans because these people...
Okay. Yeah, so if you have human trafficking going on, you definitely should arrest the people who you're saying are being trafficked.
You know, logic.
Yeah.
So I think what happened was the governor of Georgia wound up going to South Korea, tried to clean this up a bit. And mm-hmm. I think State Department sent somebody to South Korea as well, although it wasn't Marco Rubio, so they weren't. There's concern of you know, showing respect and showing respect and Eastern cultures is probably more important. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the final upshot is that they're still continuing with the plant and they hope it'll be done in 2027. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, this is the kind of stuff where it's like, I mean, beyond the fact that like this is just illegal stuff for showmanship and it has no actual practical effect, right? Like these people weren't then deported.
Well, no. Essentially they were deported. So, I mean, they were held in a detention center for like a week or so. And some of them complained about the conditions that they said that mm-hmm. there was like, you know, the human rights were violated.
Yeah. No, what I mean is like, these weren't people that like were trying to stay in the United States. Like they came here for a particular purpose for
right.
like a job.
Right.
And they were always going to go back.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, we found the criminals and we sent them back because they're the bad guy. You know, like it's just the whole thing is like this
stupid,
stupid. It's this bizarre showmanship. And I don't know that Americans are falling for it. Fingers crossed.
I think in general, we don't, but mm-hmm. I did see some pictures from a war-torn Portland.
Oh yes, with the large suits.
The guy in the chicken suit.
Blow up suits. The chicken suit. Yeah, yeah.
But that's a topic for another time. Anyway, so I was kind of interested in this story because it was just such overreach, I think, and stupid overreach, and
mm-hmm. and overreach that ultimately is going to hurt us.
That's right.
Right. Like, it hurt the individuals. Like, they lost their liberty for that time. They were treated poorly. Their human rights were violated. That's all very bad. They also are victims. And the United States hurt itself.
Right. Except, you can say, well, this is involved renewable energies and all kinds of things. So maybe if this was a factory for making, internal combustion engines that would not do it or something.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. You ever, I know that you were around when we played Pokemon as children. Did you ever play Pokemon the game, like the Game Boy game?
No.
There's something that can happen in Pokemon where if your Pokemon's fighting another one and your Pokemon gets confused, if it goes to attack, like it goes to punch, it can miss but hit itself. So it hurts itself. So it punches itself instead. So that's what this reminds me of. And like the screen would say, like, you know, Pikachu is confused and punched himself and caused damage. And I'm like, yeah, the United States punched and caused damage to itself. That is what happens. Yep. That's it.
Yeah. I have some follow up on some of the stories from previous shows, but we can do that at the end. So anyway, that's my that's my story for September.
Okay. That's the serious story. My serious story is about shaken baby syndrome, which you may know that I have a little bit too much knowledge of. And I want to preface this by saying, my dear listeners, we are going to be talking about shaken baby syndrome for the next 10 or 15-ish minutes. That does involve stories about abuse to children and death of children. So if this is not your thing, by all means, skip. But there's some really interesting legal cases happening right now, one out of Texas and then one that's pending in Jersey that kind of interact. So the main case I want to talk about is a man named Robert Roberson, who has been on death row in Texas since 2003.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was convicted of killing his 2-year-old daughter, Nikki, allegedly by shaking her to death, though that record gets kind of unclear, and I'll explain why. But she was presented to the hospital unresponsive. She died within the day. The doctors looked at her and said, oh my God, she has all the injuries associated with shaken baby syndrome. He was the adult with her. He must have shaken her to death. And that was pretty much his conviction. And he's maintained his innocence all of this time. He always said, I didn't hurt her. I didn't do anything. What he said was she had fallen off the bed in the middle of the night and he hurt her. And that, you know, kids do that, like especially toddlers, they toddle. She had fallen off the bed and he woke up to the sound of her falling and crying. He'd picked her up, comforted her. She went back to sleep. And then when he woke up, she was unresponsive. The other interesting thing about Nikki was she was very ill. She had pneumonia, very severe pneumonia in both of her lungs and had been prescribed a lot of medication. So he was always saying it was a medical issue. I did not hurt this child. But the doctor said it had to have been shaken baby syndrome. So I have worked on several shaken baby cases. So I know, as a criminal defense attorney, so I know a good amount about this topic. I've had some of my own cases. I've worked on other people's cases. And colleagues of mine have had cases, including in New Jersey, where we have an important one that's pending before our Supreme Court right now. So I'll just give like a brief summary of the history, because to understand why there is such a problem with the shaken baby diagnosis now, the easiest way to understand that is to look at how it developed. And I will do my best to not get too technical in all this. So basically, up until like the 50s or 60s, people didn't really report child abuse at all. Child abuse was considered like a family issue. Like if you were getting hit at home, there wasn't like a requirement of your teachers to tell anybody. There really wasn't involvement. And that started to change as laws started to be passed to make teachers mandatory reporters, doctors mandatory reporters. There became this push to protect children from abuse at home, which is perfectly fair and a good idea. Simultaneously, there was a doctor named Dr. Omaya who was doing whiplash studies for car accidents with monkeys.
Okay.
Yeah. Where they basically, as kind of gruesome, and I don't think you could do this anymore, but like back in the day, you could do different scientific studies. They basically put monkeys in cars and crashed them and then autopsied the monkeys to see what kind of injuries do you get internally from a whiplash injury without head impact at a 30 mile per hour crash. And what they found was neck damage and internal brain bleeding, basically, from that kind of whiplash, which was interesting. It was telling us things about how the brain is working in the circulatory system and the neck and that kind of stuff. I'm trying to remember the exacts of the studies. I don't remember if the monkey study there was neck damage or not, but you guys can look all this stuff up. because there's like a million of these things. And there's several books written on this. So anyway, Dr. Amaya is studying whiplash. He's seeing, the important thing is he's seeing brain bleeding in the monkeys. There's a doctor over in England, Dr. Gulf Kelch, who is still alive and is now an advocate against shaken baby syndrome. Dr. Gulf Kelch sees these whiplash studies, sees this push for, you know, protecting children, protecting babies. And he says, I have all these babies presenting to me who have this brain bleeding. They have the same brain bleeding as the monkeys from this whiplash study. I wonder if there's a similar mechanism. Like if these babies are being physically shaken and their heads are whiplashing, if it would cause the same thing. So he put that out as a hypothesis. And he initially called it like shaken whiplash syndrome, something along that, like tying it to that whiplash study. It wasn't studied at that point. He just proposed as a hypothesis uh-huh. and wrote like a paper where he's like, I wonder if this could be. Normally in the scientific and medical community at that point, there would be like rigorous testing on that. There'd be like studies designed to test those forces. And like there's various ways to study shaking. But that's not what happened. What happened was an American doctor, Dr. Caffey, took Dr. Gulfketch's paper and began applying it and basically said, if your baby has these certain symptoms that originally came from this whiplash study, then your baby was shaken.
Oh.
And he got really popular and it like took off like wildfire through like the 60s, 70s, 80s that like the dangers of shaking your baby, even the lightest shake could cause problems. Mm-hmm. They used to like make parents in hospitals watch videos about not shaking. Did they do that with you guys when you had me and Chris?
No.
Okay. It's like mandatory now that before you leave a hospital, they show you a video about how to not shake your baby. So this idea took off. And basically what it developed into in this time period was that doctors would make specifically pediatricians or child abuse pediatricians, which became a subspecialty, would make the diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome based on a triad of symptoms. And that triad would be bleeding in the brain, bleeding in the eyes, and some third symptom. You can kind of pick your third symptom. So you can see the problems maybe with this diagnosis already. Usually it was like a neurological thing, like a seizure.
Right.
And like brain bleeding, eye bleeding, and seizures are all related.
Right.
Like when the pressure in your skull increases because of like a bleed, your eyes bleed and you have things like seizure activity. Like that's all like connected. So then they started diagnosing and we start getting cases of shaken baby syndrome as a diagnosis. And then we start getting cases of shaken baby syndrome as a criminal trial and criminal charges. And there was a very famous case, Woodward, I think it was, like it was a nanny. Who was tried and convicted of shaking a child in her care. And she was adamant she did not do it, but it was just based on the diagnosis. So this starts happening. In the late 80s, a new field of science comes in called biomechanics, which is math. And biomechanics, yeah, we love math. Biomechanics is a field that's pretty much studies forces on the human body,
okay,
generally. So that's like what we use to test cars to make sure seatbelts are the right strength, right. Airbags mm-hmm. are safe, you know, all that kind of stuff. The reason that like at your child's playground, there's like a soft foamy thing on the ground as opposed to like gravel is because biomechanically, we know that if we put gravel or concrete there, your kid's dying when he falls off the slide. But if we put the soft rubber, he's going to be fine, right? So a lot of safety features, helmets, cars, things like that, are rooted in biomechanical science, and it's very reliable because it's just physics and math. So it's not anyone's opinion. It's not anyone's thoughts or feelings or anything like that. A doctor came along named Dr. Duhaime who wanted to prove that shaking does in fact cause the triad. She was a proponent of shaken baby syndrome, and she wanted to prove biomechanically that you can shake, that an adult human can shake a child hard enough to cause these specific symptoms. So she did a study in 1987. And unfortunately, she proved the opposite.
How did she do the study? What did she shake?
They shook biofidelic dolls. So there's lots of different kinds of dummies you can use, with, like in car accidents, where they're dummies that have like wiring inside.
Okay, so you can measure the forces and whatnot, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we are actually pretty, like, anytime there's like a physical injury like that, it's actually pretty easy to reproduce it in the lab. You just need the right, you know, tech.
Okay.
But you can reproduce it in the lab. She tried, and she concluded that, and it's a direct quote from her study, shaking alone does not cause the shaken baby syndrome. She did, however, because she was upset by that, she did, however, also have the people in the study shake the dolls and hit them against a surface.
Oh.
And the impact was enough force to cause these injuries, which makes sense. Blunt force trauma, very dangerous, especially bad to the head of anyone, especially an infant, right? So what she proposed was shake and impact. So she was like, you could have shaking followed by impact, and that's how you can get these symptoms. But shaking and impact are two totally different mechanisms of abuse. They're like two completely different things. But that team, you know, wanted to suture those things together. After that, in 1987, the diagnosis just kind of continues to be applied. And that's when Robert Robertson's case happens in 2003, when his daughter dies, and he's ultimately convicted right around 2000. So he is in right in the center of when shaken baby is like at its full force. It's like at its strongest. There's really no opponents to it. There's nobody really questioning it. Even though we have this biomechanical question kind of lingering, no one's really looking into it. So what, so he's has his case going on. Around the same time, there's another biomechanist named John Plunkett, who passed away a few years ago, who starts investigating shortfalls. Because John Plunkett looks at this study from the 80s and he's like, but if shaking can't do it, then why are all these kids sick? Like, there are all these sick kids. There are all these babies that are under a year old that are having this issue. What's going on? And he does several very thorough studies about shortfalls. And the gist of it is that shortfalls onto hard surfaces can cause the injuries used to diagnose shaken baby syndrome.
Just the falls.
Just the fall. And there's a lot, there's actually a lots and lots of confirmed shortfall cases. Like, we're at the park and everybody sees the kid fall off the swing. Everybody, you know, so everybody sees the kid fall off the bed, you know, there's even ones that are filmed that were like caught on camera that when the accident happens, right? And a lot of these kids are fine. And the vast majority of the cases, the children are okay. There's a sliver of them where unfortunately the children do die. So they're very serious. So John Plunkett basically concludes, we don't have biomechanical evidence that shaking by itself causes these particular injuries that we're using to diagnose shaking. We don't have that evidence. But we do have evidence that blunt force impact, whether intentional or accidental from a short fall, does cause these injuries. So when these parents are bringing their kids into the hospital saying he rolled off the changing table and now he's having a seizure, it's not correct to say the parent's lying. It couldn't possibly have been that. It's only shaking. It in fact could be that shortfall. So then throughout like the 2000s into the mid 2010s, more biomechanists start to get involved. And there's a number of them that some of whom I've worked with personally on cases who are like really excellent, who study shortfalls and shaking. And the biomechanical community overall has basically concluded, as of now, we cannot prove that an adult human shaking an infant causes these symptoms. That's not to say it's good to shake your children. Please don't shake babies. It's probably very bad for them. It probably damages their neck. But one of the things about shaken baby syndrome is it doesn't involve neck injury. Shaken baby syndrome only involves, it's not one of the symptoms of the triad. And if you look at the cases, it's not recorded in those cases.
That's weird.
Exactly. Shaken baby syndrome, classic shaken baby syndrome, only involves brain bleeding, eye bleeding, and then usually a neurological symptom. It almost never involves neck injury. So that's kind of happening. The American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't like that it's starting to get challenged, because now in the early 2000s through 2010, like, court cases are starting to come up where the defense is coming out with like actual hard science about this. So in 2009, the American Academy of Pediatrics, God bless, changes the name of the syndrome from shaken baby syndrome to abusive head trauma.
Okay.
And they say specifically in their paper that they are doing that because of legal challenges to shaken baby syndrome. So it's not like a scientific basis. And what they say in their 2009 statement, the AAP says, we're broadening it basically for abusive head trauma to include any abuse about the head.
Okay.
So that includes any abuse about the head now falls into that category, but it includes shaken baby syndrome, which still survived at that point. Cases across the country, across the world are litigated about this. They pick up. All of this time, Robertson's on death row, doing appeals, trying to not get executed for something he didn't do. And then in 2017, a case in New Jersey came up, Daryl Nieves, which was a similar set of facts to Robertson, but Mr. Nieves' son survived, which is good, and that child's fine. Mr. Nieves had a very medically fragile child. And you guys can look up, by the way, there's like articles about both of these cases if you want to read more. But basically, Mr. Nieves had a very medically fragile child who was displaying seizure symptoms and presented to the hospital because the parents were, you know, they're like, our infant is not breathing, please help. And the doctors diagnosed shaken baby syndrome and they charged Mr. Nieves. There was no other evidence. There was no bruise. There was no somebody saw. There was no short fall, nothing. Said a very medically fragile infant and a diagnosis that Mr. Nieves said, I did not shake my medically fragile preemie baby. He's like, I absolutely did not do that. So that case goes to a hearing, and this was done by the Public Defender's Office in New Jersey. Shout out to the public defenders. And they won at the trial level and at the appellate level. And what's important is that the trial level judge they had specifically called shaken baby syndrome junk science.
Ooh.
Yeah. So anytime you see other courts or other news articles saying junk science, it comes from that court ruling. And which was good of the judge. It was brave of him to say that, but he's right.
Yeah.
So trial court judge says this is junk science. You can't bring this evidence in. I'm stopping you from coming into court. This is basically bullshit. Case against Mr. Nieves gets dismissed. The state, the prosecutor's office, appealed it to the New Jersey Appellate Court. The New Jersey Appellate Court wrote a beautiful opinion, which is available online, explaining the history of the science, the development, the experts that testified, everything. And the appellate court said, yeah, this is junk science. No one has proven that an adult human can shake an infant and cause these injuries. No one has proven that. Now, just as a caveat, it is possible to shake things to death. And there have been many a study where we've put various animals into machines that shake them very hard until they die. So it's not that it's impossible to shake something to death. The question specifically is, can you prove that an adult human with their adult human strength can shake an infant hard enough to cause these specific symptoms?
Right.
That through line has not been established. So the appellate court sided with the trial court. It was then appealed to the New Jersey Supreme Court. It was argued like last year. The oral arguments for that are available on the internet. They're fascinating. So I would recommend anybody to go listen to them. They haven't given a ruling yet. I know that we're waiting for that ruling to come down, but that's pending in New Jersey, and the New Jersey Supreme Court may very well side with both the appellate court and the trial court and say, this is junk. We don't really have evidence of this. And you have never proven that this is possible. And that could affect Mr. Robertson's case, because what just happened with him while all this is going on, because Nieves happens in 2017, the litigation takes like forever.
Right.
We're still waiting on the Supreme Court heard argument last year. And Robertson was supposed to be executed last October. It got delayed by like the legislature in Texas being like sneaky, basically. And they like subpoenaed him for a hearing and like ended up delaying his execution. But it was rescheduled for October 14th this year. And just, I think yesterday, the day before, the Supreme Court of Texas kicked it back to the trial court. And so they said, no execution. We have concerns about this case. because there's problems and execution is very final.
Yes.
So we need you guys to take another look at it. So they finally kicked it back to the trial court to have a new hearing. I got my hands on the documents for the Robertson case, which I think are also like generally available. What had actually happened with his daughter was that she was very sick. She had pneumonia right. for a long time. And she was being medicated by two different doctors. There was like a hospital and a doctor. And they prescribed her a combination of medications that was fatal. It was like it would suppress her breathing.
Oh.
So that's what happened, you know. Whether the short fall had anything to do with it, it may have. It's sort of unclear. But what really seems to have done it was this. It really is a medical malpractice case, unfortunately, not a criminal case, where the two
right.
prescribers weren't in communication and didn't know that they were giving what were very powerful drugs, some of which we don't prescribe to children anymore because of how strong they are, trying to treat her pneumonia, ultimately leading to a fatal combination and the death. So that's what's happening with Mr. Robertson. I'm really glad that his execution got, it's not even stayed right now. It's like canceled. They sent it back to the trial court for hearings. So that's going to be a huge case. There's going to have, and I'll keep track of it. And once we start, like, I mean, it'll probably be a while before there's like hearings and stuff, but undoubtedly they're going to have experts come and testify, biomechanical experts come and testify, you know, various kinds of neurologists and things like that come and testify, because one of the differences in the Nieves case versus other shaken baby cases before was that they called a biomechanical expert, because the other medical sciences are kind of like all arguing with each other about this
right,
diagnosis.
Right.
But the biomechanics are like, this is just physics. And this is what we can and can't prove with physics and what we know about the human body and forces on the human body. And at this point, no one has proved this action causes this result. And therefore, we can't substantiate it. So I'm sorry. I tried to make that as brief as possible. This is like one of my little hyperfixations.
Well, so I mean, the thing that happened this in September, I guess, or just recently, is the fact that they undid they pulled the execution and basically they canceled it. That's kind of important.
Yeah. No, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, and honestly, like the attorneys were like, we just want to have a hearing. And the other thing about it is people that helped put him on death row now no longer think he's guilty. So the prosecutor that put him on death row is on the defense's side now. The lead detective who put him on death row is on defense's side. The lead detective even talked about the fact, he's like given several interviews about the fact that like they gave into confirmation bias because the doctors
right.
were so sure.
Right.
Right. They were like, this has to be, it has to be this. And what do you do? You know, when you're a detective and you've got a dead kid and a doctor's like, the only thing that could have killed her was intense abuse. You're a detective. You're not going to say no.
Right.
You know? So hopefully this all goes the right way. I think going back to the trial court and having a full hearing to really explore the medical side and the biomechanical side will make a huge difference for Mr. Robertson, but also for other parents who are charged with this. Because in New Jersey, I know of multiple shaken baby cases just out of Jersey. And at least in Jersey, we don't have the death penalty or anything like that. But these other states where they have the death penalty, like we're potentially putting people to death on a diagnosis that is not scientifically sound, you know?
Right. When will the Supreme Court of New Jersey give its decision? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I speculate it'll be after the governor election.
Okay.
I think that they don't want to, because if New Jersey, I don't think they want to really rock the boat while the governor's election is going on. New Jersey's Supreme Court is very science focused. They've given a lot of really good decisions over the past 10-ish years, science-based decisions. So we have, for example, a case called Henderson, which is about eyewitness IDs. In New Jersey, we have very strict standards for how eyewitness IDs can be used based on psychological science.
Okay.
There's been other things that our Supreme Court has struck as not scientifically reliable enough to come into court that other states still use. So if the New Jersey Supreme Court strikes shaken baby syndrome, specifically shaking only, they didn't get into impact like that. The Nieves case didn't get into impact because the kid didn't fall or anything. So impact is sort of its own thing. But if they strike shaking only, shaken baby syndrome, they will be the first state in the country to do that. So it'll be like a really big deal. So I don't think they want to do it before the election.
Yeah, it's only a month, less than a month now.
Yeah. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Sometimes once I find out, I'll let you guys know. I mean, look, I listened to the arguments. I thought the judges understood the science behind it. I'm confident that they're going to, defense is going to get a good result from that. But the worst case scenario, honestly, is that the court sends it back for like a special master or something. They've done that in the past where they just like want more experts to come testify. But the record in Nieves has like a lot of experts that already testified. So I don't know how much they need anything more. But I don't know. We'll see. The court works in mysterious ways. Anyway, I'm done. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. If anyone's interested in this and wants more information, please comment. I will send you the links to things. Everything I said, you can Google. It's not, none of it's hidden. These are facts. And if you're seething right now, you're like, how dare she say shaken baby syndrome's not real? Exactly. I understand how you feel. Most people feel that way. You really need to sit down and look at the science and the history, because it's once you look at the history, you see the deep, deep flaws that led us here. So,
okay.
What's your second story?
Oh, I want to talk about Jimmy Kimmel. Do you know who Jimmy Kimmel is?
Yes. I now know who Jimmy Kimmel is. I kind of knew who he was before, but now that got a little extra airtime there, I know who he is.
Right. So for the younger people in the audience, let me just give you a brief history. So back in the good old days, there used to be TV that you received over the air. You had these antenna that, you know, like rabbit ears, and there was stations that would broadcast programs. And there were, we had like three or four channels that had different programs. And there were three major networks, which grew out of radio networks, which started back like in the 20s and 30s. So we had ABC, CBS, and NBC, right?
And Netflix.
No, there was no Netflix.
and Hulu.
No Hulu. None of that. So what happened at the time, since everybody watched the same shows, there was a very popular show that was on ABC. It was on NBC. It was called The Tonight Show. It was every evening at 11:30. And there were different hosts, but the host that is most famous was this man named Johnny Carson, which you may have heard of him. And he kind of set the format for the show. It was like a little monologue in the beginning with some jokes. And then he would like interview people, and they had a sidekick who would do announcements, and they had a band that would, you know, sometimes argue with him and stuff. So, so, you know, as anybody else, Johnny Carson got old, got retired, and other people took over. So there was Johnny Carson's spot was taken by Jay Leno. And then they wanted to do other shows in that same format. So there was the Tonight Show was from like 11:30 to 12:30 in the evening. And then they had The Late Show. It started at 12:30 after that. And and so every network had a show like that. So, and I'm not sure, Jimmy Kimmel is on ABC. I don't remember now what show ABC had for that kind of time slot. But so that's kind of the history. So traditionally, these shows kind of just continued. Different people took over. So nowadays, we have Jimmy Fallon, who does The Tonight Show. We have Stephen Colbert, who does The Late Show. We have Seth Meyers, which is some other show of whatever that's called. And Jimmy Kimmel, which is called Jimmy Kimmel Live. His show is filmed in L.A. And all those shows were also done in front of a live audience. So even though they were sometimes they were taped, sometimes they were live, but there was always a live audience in the studio, right? So Jimmy Kimmel actually had a show many years ago on Comedy Central, I believe. There was a show called The Man Show.
Oh, he was on that?
That's right. It was Jimmy Kimmel, another guy. You know, do you remember?
I didn't realize that was the same guy. I do remember The Man Show. I mean, I didn't watch much of The Man Show, but I'm aware of The Man Show.
Your brother and I watched The Man Show because we especially
I recall that.
The girls on trampolines. Anyway, so Jimmy Kimmel has a show from L.A., and his monologues very often make fun of Trump. And attack him and just, you know, rib him a lot. I mean, in the past, before the Trump got into politics, Trump appeared on as a guest on his show because of his other stuff. So when the Charlie Kirk was killed, right, everybody was freaking out. And on one night, Jimmy Kimmel just made a small comment on that. He said, "It's a terrible thing that happened, but I bet you the guy who did it was a MAGA supporter." And at the time, nobody knew one way or the other. You know, other people were saying he's a communist or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so people on the right especially got outraged by this comment. So what happened was the chairman of the FCC, this guy named Brendan Carr, let's go Brendan, appeared on some podcast and he said this: "We can do it the easy way or the hard way. These companies can find a way to change conduct and to take action on Kimmel, or, you know, there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead." Mm-hmm. Now, these days, ABC is owned by Disney, and they were trying to merge with some other company, and a lot of these mergers have to be approved by the FCC. FCC is the one that regulates broadcasters, right? So ABC kind of panicked after that comment, and they suspended the show.
Yes.
So, and that caused immense outrage. Yep. So audiences got pissed off. About 1.5 million people canceled the Disney Plus subscription.
Mm-hmm. Us included, yes. Yep.
And many actors signed letters saying, "This is terrible. This is, we are, you know, this is, we have free speech. We have First Amendment. Just because you don't like speech doesn't mean it should be suppressed. And in fact, some of the people who spoke for Jimmy Kimmel included people like, you know, Ted Cruz, for example. Mm-hmm. Right. So Tucker Carlson. Right.
You know, a broken clock is right twice a day.
Well, you know, Ted Cruz made a valid point when he said, "Look, when the power changes in Washington, do you want them to do the same thing to, you know, our side?" Right. So, so what happened was after about a week, they reinstated the show. Now, going back to these old TV network days, you know, the way the TV worked is that, you know, there was a major station that broadcast the show, but there were like affiliate stations locally because, you know, radio waves don't reach that far throughout the country. And those stations these days are owned by these fairly conservative organizations. Sinclair is one. I forget the other one's name. So they said, "You could put Jimmy Kimmel back in L.A., but we're not going to broadcast in our station." So they had some other stupid show on at that sign slot. Mm-hmm. And after about another week, they just all gave in because people complained. So Jimmy Kimmel actually did a very nice kind of monologue when he came back. And he, of course, he didn't say he wasn't going to apologize or anything. You know, he just said he was very sorry what happened to Charlie Kirk because it's, you know, he was Charlie Kirk. Whatever he was also a father and a husband. He had two young children who now don't have a father. So that was an interesting victory for speech and free speech. And it shows you that, you know, people just getting together and acting together works.
Absolutely. No, I thought it was a great example of the fact that it's like these companies that seem like indestructible, that seem like we can't touch them, actually are very much reliant on our money.
Yep.
And their reputations. I mean, look, a company can lose their reputation in a hot second. And in effect, like, people make decisions about where they're going to purchase things based on the reputations of the companies. So I thought that was great. I do think, you know, in a larger political way, you know, obviously fascism is bad and we don't like anything that good orange dictator is doing. I do think a lot of the more extreme things will fail because Americans are so used to having specifically free speech,
right?
Like specifically the ability to go on Facebook and post what I want or go on TikTok and post what I want and watch my friends post what they want. And like, people are pretty sensitive to censorship kind of across the board. So I think there's, frankly, I think the country's just too big for the government really successfully censor.
I hope you're right. I mean, historically, the United States is quite different from other countries where this sort of stuff happened. Now, just one thing I want to say is that when Jimmy Kimmel came back, like he did his whole, he talked about what happened and stuff, and says, and I also have a statement from Disney I would not read to you. So he takes a piece of paper and he says, to resubscribe to Disney.
Yeah, obviously. And I mean, I was sad when we were like, oh, well, we have to cancel our Disney Plus subscription because I like watching stuff on there. There are shows I watch, whatever, but it's like, I'm not going to sit by, and I can't, there's very little I can do, but one thing I can do is stop paying for this, you know? And I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's like a fair response, and clearly en masse makes a difference. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So that was my good feel story for this past month.
Yeah. Oh, okay. My good feel story, I promise it'll be shorter than the last one, did you know Taylor Swift came out with a new album?
I heard something. Did she do something in the movies as well?
She did. She did do something in the movies as well. Oh, I wish I was home. I could show you my sparkle jacket that I wore in the movies.
Oh, you went to it?
Of course I went. I went to the premiere. I took the day off of work. What are you talking about?
Naturally, of course. Yeah.
So Taylor Swift released a new album called The Life of a Showgirl. It's awesome. I will hear no critique. I accept no critique. And I have a very specific message for a very, very niche audience. I will hear no critique from the folklore Swifties about the lyricism on The Life of a Showgirl when the primary lyric of the lead single from the folklore album was, "And when I felt like an old cardigan under someone's bed, you put me on and said I was your favorite." That is the primary lyric in the lead single from folklore. And all the folklore Swifties are like, "It's the best writing she's ever done." I'm like, hello? Are we on the same planet? What are you talking about? And they're all like, her lyrics for this album aren't good. And I'm like, you're illiterate. So I don't know what to call it. So I will accept no critique.
Okay.
But the album's done remarkably well. Shocker. I did finally get to participate in staying up till midnight. So normally she releases like a midnight on a Friday, like going into a Friday. And I almost always have work that day, so I can't stay up. But I didn't have to go to work the next day. I didn't have anything on in court or any cases or jail or anything like that. So I was able to take the day off. And I did stay up to midnight. I did listen to the album when it premiered. I watched it on YouTube when it had like, the songs had like 100 views. I was like one of the first. I was like, it was great. It was great. And then the next day I went to the movie. The movie was really cute. I'm glad that she did that. It was interesting to get some like behind the scenes stuff. The interesting thing about it is the just bizarre online discourse that happens every time Taylor Swift releases an album. And it's like we have like mass amnesia about this. And I want to ask you a question too. I have a music question for you. So the problem people have when Taylor Swift releases an album is the following. Initially, if it drops, people rush to listen to the whole thing. And then they want to give you their like immediate hot take. And a lot of times that immediate hot take is, I don't like it. It's different than what I expected. It's not good, whatever. And then 3 to 6 weeks later, everyone's like, this is a masterpiece. That has happened with, I think, all of her albums, but the first three. And that was because she wasn't that big back then. Mm-hmm. So people weren't listening to it at midnight. But all of her albums have had that same pattern. And I wanted to know from you, is there like a reason when it comes to like listening to new music, like what you think, why when you hear an entire album of new music, you might be like, you might like initially reject it, but then like come around to it?
Yeah, that's actually very typical. So my favorite case is there was a trumpeter named Miles Davis, right? Mm-hmm. And he became very popular. I think one of his albums probably still like the biggest selling jazz album ever, which was recorded back in the 50s. So he switched styles several times throughout his career. So he had this like this one album that is called Kind of Blue. It was like this cool jazz style and was very popular. Like anybody who's like wants to be cool and thinks there's a jazz fan when they're not really one, they will have that album.
Tell me how you really feel. Okay.
But then Miles Davis just said, okay, I've done enough of those. So let me just switch around. And he completely changed his style of music and put out in like album with electric guitars and rock influenced stuff. And people hated it. Says, no, we want the old Miles. And then he went around and he did something else. So he, several times in his career, he really dramatically switched direction. Beatles kind of went through something slightly similar, right? Because they were really a pop group and everybody wanted them to produce these, you know, I love you, do, you know, songs. And then they started doing something more ambitious and more complicated. People, you know, had kind of objected to the change. But that's I think that's normal, because then once you get exposed to the new stuff, listen to it for a while, realize that if the musician is great, you know, what they do, whether it's this particular style or something else. And, you know, if you're an artist, you don't want to just do the same thing over and over, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about it a lot because of this pattern, because this when I say this happens every time, I mean, I've been a Swiftie since the jump. I'm like a teardrops on my guitar, Swiftie. I was there. I, you know, do not speak the old magics to me. I was there when it was written, you know, like I was there from, and I was the target audience, right? I'm the age range and I'm the demographic for Taylor Swift music the entire time. And I like country music. So when she started, I wasn't just into the poppy stuff. I was also into her country stuff. But I've been thinking about it a lot because it really does happen where it's like, so she does like several country albums. Then she came out with the album Red, which was her first like country-ish, pop-ish album. And it just got like, people were like, it's awful. It's terrible. She's her 15 minutes are done, like all this. And now it's like a classic. Like people are like, wow, it's amazing how many good tracks are on this. Like it's a no skip album almost. Like it's really, really good. And I thought about the last album that she had, The Tortured Poets Department, which is very different from Showgirl in like aesthetic and sound and like that. I always considered myself someone who didn't like The Tortured Poets Department, and no critique to her, just wasn't my kind of music. Right. Music piece is very subjective, and that's fine. I remember when I first listened to it, The Tortured Poets Department has like 30 tracks. It is long. She's a long album. And I remember I listened to it all the way through one time, and I was like so overwhelmed. I'm like, this is a lot, Taylor. Like, I don't know what exactly to do with this. And I just went back a few days ago to look at the track list, because I was like, there are some songs, though, that I know I later came around on Tortured Poets. There's like a few, and I'm thinking there's probably like four or five. Out of 30 songs, 15 songs, I regularly listen to and know all the words to. So 15. That could have been an album in and of itself, right? You know? And I just don't like the sound of the other ones because they're just not my style of music. But it's interesting because I had never realized, like, oh, wait, no, I do like the Tortured Poets Department. I don't like every single song, but I do actually like that album, and I do regularly listen to those songs. I wonder if it's part of it's just like, for me, it's like whenever I'm forced to engage with new media, because it's new, it takes like more brain energy to like to listen and to understand and to,
well, you have to listen. So it's like often people put music in the background, but you know, when you listen to music, if the artist is good, the more you listen to it, the more you discover, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool thing about some of this art.
Yeah. What I like about Life of the Showgirl, I like all the tracks. For me, it's like basically a no skip album. I just play it through. Mm-hmm. The only other one, my actual favorite Taylor Swift album is Evermore, which she released on my birthday just for me.
That's nice.
That's it. Yeah. She said, Caroline, here you are. An album just for you. I said, thanks, Taylor. Taylor, my personal friend that I know. Thanks. which is funny because Evermore is like, because of the way she released it and like album sales and stuff, it was like, so Folklore was a surprise album at the beginning of COVID that she just dropped with no warning. And it like took off. And I was always dubious and remain dubious of Folklore. I'm not I'm not a folklore girly. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Okay. The folklore girlies can have their cardigans. That's fine. But Evermore came out later that same year because she was inside and she just kept writing songs. And she just has a recording studio, so she just made another one. That one was also a surprise drop, but like she dropped it in December, and that meant like the record sales were calculated different or some such thing. So it's like her least well-performing album. So Taylor never talks about Evermore. And I'm like, please, please talk about Evermore. We love it. We love it, Taylor. I promise. Just because it didn't sell well doesn't mean we didn't love it. But Life of a Showgirl is doing very well. It's broken a bunch of records.
Well, one thing I heard, right? So with the little movie that came out with it, apparently mm-hmm. earned more money than some other movies that got released that weekend. Like,
yep. And the tickets were cheap. The tickets were like $12 or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't expensive. It was really fun, too. I wore my Eras Tour outfit. I made bracelets, friendship bracelets for it. I traded them with the other adult women who were there in the middle of the day on a Friday. It was really interesting to see her like explanations of writing the songs. She's a big Shakespeare fan.
Okay.
And I would love to show that to Mom because she gives like one of her songs is called The Fate of Ophelia.
Right. I've been hearing about that.
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
There was an article in New York Times, I believe, this week about all the songs about Ophelia. There's a dozen at least.
Yeah. What she did for The Fate of Ophelia was she said, like the main lyric is, "You saved my heart from the fate of Ophelia."
Okay.
So she's saying, like, I would have drowned, or like my heart would have drowned, right. but for you.
That's basically a nice sentiment.
Yeah, yeah, it was like a nice, and the music video is really interesting too. They have so much money over there; they can just do anything they want. So it's like visually very interesting. My favorite song, because I know everyone cares very much about this. It's very important information. I really love the song Father Figure. She interpolated George Michael's song Father Figure.
Okay.
But she reinterpreted the concept because like the original, you know, the original song.
Not really, no.
How does it go? The original. I can be your father figure. Put your tiny hand in my, that one. Okay. You would know it if you heard it. It's a great song. That song's genuinely about like being someone's father figure, like helping someone in like that role. Taylor reinterpreted it to be like a powerful businessman trying to like control his protege.
Oh.
And that backfired.
Oops.
and so it's like really interesting. I really like the beat for that one. Fate of Ophelia is great. Elizabeth Taylor's great. Opalite's great. She wrote a song called Wood that is about exactly what you think it's about.
Okay.
But it's very clever because it's all written about like things that are lucky or unlucky. So the main lyric is, I don't have to knock on wood. Like, I don't have to do these things to be lucky because I have you. But that's like the very thin cover for what it's actually about. But when she was interviewed for it, they were like, what's wood about? And she's like, it's about luck. That's it.
Okay.
So it was very cute. So strong recommend. If anyone out there hears Taylor Swift slander, you tell them they're wrong. And that like she's broken a bunch of records with the album already with the streams and the sales. And the sales, by the way, isn't just because there's like lots of variants. But people are always like, it's because she releases so many different variants. First of all, we like the variants. It's fun. Second of all, I'm not good at math, but people that are better at math on the internet have explained this. So you could look it up. The way the record sales are counted is not because there are so many variants. Also, everybody releases variants now, so fuck you.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah. So happy Taylor Swift time for anyone who's celebrating.
Thank you. So before we're done, I have a couple of notes on some previous topics that came up in the news. Mm-hmm. So remember when we talked about the Big Bad Bill?
Yes.
And they were trying to put in a...
It was just one bark. Maybe we can keep going. I'm like a hostage.
remember they were trying to put a provision in the Big Bad Bill that said... states were not allowed to do any regulation of AI.
Right.
And I got kicked out. And that, mm-hmm. Well, you know, they don't give up. So I guess this summer, White House put out this document called the AI Action Plan, mm-hmm. which basically kind of tries to define the policy for the federal government, what it will do about AI. And one of the provisions in it is that they will withhold federal funding from any state that will pass any regulations that they don't like.
You know, at least they're persistent. You know, they're persistent. They're dedicated. They're dedicated to it. Why? Why does it matter? Should that be?
I don't know if you've heard about Peter Thiel, who is one of these big tech bros, said that.
Yeah.
Any regulation on AI will lead to quicker coming of the Antichrist.
I forgot about the coming of the Antichrist. Of course. Why did I not think of that? Oh, I should have made that connection. Thank you, Peter Thiel, for your...
Now you know. So the other thing that came up that I noticed that Financial Times must have listened to our early episode when we talk about the orange is the new green.
Yeah, uh-huh, okay.
Because they had an article basically said, you know, because of all the various policies that Trump is implementing that's improving the condition of the planet, and specifically talk about shipping, because there's less stuff, because of tariffs, there's less shipping, and container ships pollute a lot, so they pollute less.
Wow. He's the climate activist we were dreaming of.
Right. Yes. And then the final story. So remember, we talked about the various policies of this administration's trying to kill all kinds of green projects and stuff. So there was a wind farm being constructed off the coast of Rhode Island, Connecticut, and they suspended the construction on it. So between when we talked about it and now, a judge came saying, you can't do that. And they restarted it. So they're going to finish it up. Meanwhile, they've canceled I just read about it this weekend. Very large solar project in Arizona. It would have been huge, huge solar farm that would provide electricity to like 7 million people. Mm-hmm. But they're trying to, well, they stopped construction and they're trying to revoke the permits or whatever. So we'll see what happens there. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I think, you know, especially people in oil industry or coal industry don't like solar or wind is because the fuel for those plants is free and anybody can get it. You know, sunshine is and wind is everywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, those were just the kind of little follow-ups on stuff we talked about before.
Oh, that's good. And the final question is, which guitar do you have there behind you? I just noticed your guitar is there.
This is my Ibanez.
Oh, fancy. Oh.
Pat Metheny. Fancy. Model with a Charlie Christian pickup.
How many guitars do you have at this point?
Not enough.
Yes, that's the right answer.
The question
all right,
is,
well, I think...
Okay, let's finish.
No, go ahead. No, what were you going to say?
So the question is, how many guitars does a person need? And the answer is one more.
Ah, yes. That's what I'm going to say next weekend when I go to the Ren Fair about jars of honey, because I get to buy my jars of honey for the year next week. And I do, in my defense, I do use a lot of honey.
You do.
I drink a lot of tea.
Yes.
I do. It doesn't go to waste. I just, do I need 12 of them? Well, I need one more.
Right.
You know, you never know what flavor honey you're going to want. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed our very strange collection of stories this time. And we will see you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Being grabbed...
There must be a person near the house.
Lilo doesn't approve.
Lilo is a guard dog, and she said there should be no people here.
Can we not? We can have neighbors. Other people live here.
I apologize. And again, I blame Chris.